me from the chief whip office as to the chairperson. I didn't receive any such notice in black and white, so I can't proceed with electing a chairperson going beyond, today.
The name of Donald Mlindwa Gumede as the acting chairperson. Thank you.
Okay, any seconder for that nomination? Just your name, please, for the record.
Okay, thank you. My name is Cindy Chikunga. I hereby second the name of Mr. Gumede. Thank you.
Okay, we have a seconder for that. Any further nominations? None. Then Mr. Gumede stands elected as the chairperson for this meeting. Congratulations, and you may take the chair.
Honourable members, the Auditor General and his team, I would like to welcome you to this meeting, and to the members I would like to say thank you. I'll be acting, but not as in Hollywood. I'll do my task for the day, and then we'll deal with the issues as a team. But without much ado, I would come back to the agenda. We have dealt with item one. We have dealt with item two. I wouldn't like to have a speech for a welcome, except to say that we as members are very much honored to have the Auditor General and his full team here, and we hope that in our interaction the public and eventually the country will benefit in line with our constitutional arrangements and in line with the Constitution. And therefore, without much ado, I would like to call upon the Auditor General to take the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to the honourable members. If I may start, Chair, by just reinforcing who is here from the office. The list does have the names, but I think it's important to just highlight that we have brought with us a full contingent of a team that is meant to provide the primary leadership when it comes to implementing the strategy, and has been at the forefront of developing the strategy as well. Other than myself, or in addition to myself, the Deputy Auditor General, supported by the Head of Audit, which is Wally van Yerden, next to the Deputy Auditor General, as well as the the head of our audit support unit, which is known as the Chief Operating Officer, Mlindelwa Jabavu. Those are the two pillars that form the, can I say, the foundation of the operations in working with the Deputy AG in keeping the organization insane, so to speak. With those teams, as you know, the head of audit has got a contingent of senior executives that manage the audit who are not here today. They are busy with the APEC conference as we speak to be where the action is insofar as audit matters are concerned. But with us here, well, amongst the chief operating officer's team will be the key people that have put together the budget and will be running with the numbers for this organization. The chief operator, financial officer, Raj, who is where is Raj? Oh, they're next to Lindelwa. And then the head of governance, Wandile Tutani, and then head of strategy, Tabile Dube. Right at the far end is Tsietsi, who is managing the DAG's office to make sure that everything is in order in putting all this information together and managing and monitoring the implementation of this plan, assisting the Deputy AG. You all know Adil, who is next to me, who is part of the governance team. I hope I haven't left anyone here. All right. So that's who the team is today, and we think Chair will be enriched immensely from today's discussion in deliberating on this document and taking it forward, and would welcome any inputs from yourselves in terms of issues that perhaps we may be needing to pay attention to. This Chair is with the understanding that you do have a couple of months or weeks rather to consider the document, having submitted it 6 months before our year end for your consideration. We would more than welcome your input, so that if there are matters that we do need to consider, we will respect that and deal with those accordingly. We also are fully aware of the fact that this document has been given sufficient attention and consideration on our side, and it is a complete document insofar as we could understand our business and the issues that we would like to drive for the business. But understanding that no man is infallible, we are open to any inputs in terms of your role as a parliamentary oversight body over this institution. Yeah. A second eye is always a good eye to pick up issues that us as the people that have been too close to this business may not be easily picked up by ourselves. So with that, Chair, I would just like to thank the committee also for having met at short notice to accommodate us in considering and deliberating this document, which will help us to start applying our minds on the future of the organization. So thanks very much for that. And particularly, Chair, to thank you for coordinating and making it possible for this meeting to be held today. Thanks very much for that. In terms of how we planned the proceedings on our side, I'll just make a brief introduction, which is contained on page 6 of the document that was submitted. And then the essence of the details that are contained in the document, DAG will lead us in that discussion for the rest of the day, assisted by the team that I have just introduced, in providing clarity and responding to any specific questions that may emerge. But on my side, Chair, before I hand over to Kimi, is to just say that this document, just to echo your words, Chair, that this is a document that we see important in popularizing the mandate that we have as an institution to strengthen the democracy of the country and thus building the confidence of the public insofar as accountability is concerned in South Africa. And in looking at this document, we have made sure also that it does affirm what this business is about, which to a large extent is about auditing. But for us to do this auditing effectively, we've just also revisited and relooked at our vision, that if you are to be auditing effectively, we need to be seen by those that are looking at us to be effective in what we're doing. Hence the emphasis in this vision on the recognition that the stakeholders have got to identify with us insofar as enhancing public sector accountability is concerned. And that's the simplistic wording that has been put into the revised vision that we have identified for ourselves. You realize, Chair, that this is a change from the previous vision that we've held, which had run its course and has positioned the institution in terms of the profile that we needed to build for the organization then, which was to position ourselves amongst the players in the world of auditing and also to position ourselves clearly as an audit institution, but also position ourselves as being seen to be adding value. So it's an extension to that initial thinking to say, in essence, what does it mean? And we're saying, if the stakeholders that we relate to can recognize that, that's what we'd like to see happening in the next foreseeable future. But for us to be able to do that, there are concrete things that we need to be focusing on and displaying and demonstrating. And these are the five bullets that are highlighted on page 6. That our messages in our core product, which is the auditing, have got to be relevant. And for them to be relevant, they need to be understood clear. They need to also be simple. And it's for this reason, whether we're doing performance audits, whether we're doing regularity audits, or any type of audit, this is the cornerstone of how we should be communicating in order for us to live up to the vision that we have subscribed to. And for this to take root also, it's important that this message doesn't get assumed to be understood, but we need to drive that understanding. And it's in this respect that our visibility as the leadership of this organization has got to be paramount. Not only from, I guess, myself as the AG, but the entire leadership of auditing, the entire leadership of this institution, whether we are auditors or not, because each and every one of us has got a role to play in popularizing what we are doing in this institution. If we are to lead by example in terms of how we manage administration, that needs to be seen by the rest of the public and say, when we talk about good administration, good financial management, they need to see that happening within our institution. And it's for that reason that we're not only highlighting auditors as being visible, but the entire leadership being visible in terms of how we lead by example. And these are the things that we need to be communicating in every platform that we happen to be involved in communicating our key messages. No doubt there is a contingent of 1,800 to 2,000 people that will be doing the detailed day-to-day work. And these are the people that we need to make sure that they're properly structured, properly resourced, properly trained, properly positioned in order to make sure that the work that we do and deliver is done with the right level of quality, the right level of discipline as well. And core amongst that is our trainee accounting scheme, which is a fundamental pillar of our auditing activity, our pipeline for future training, our pipeline for future managers, and succession planning for the leadership as well. So it is that scheme that has been revived to make sure that it takes into account the management of that strategy from beginning to the end. Not only managing the trainee accounting scheme as only a 3-year cycle for people that come for traineeship, but are able to identify them from school level right through to leadership level and be able to have that foresight in the way in which we manage this can I call it the engine room of human capital in this organization. Chief amongst all these issues is how it translates into financial results. And hence the reference to the funding model that we had had an opportunity to discuss extensively in the last few months. And these documents, this strategy, these numbers, budgets, have taken cognizance of the fundamental assumptions that have been deliberated extensively with SCOWEC and to position our funding model in a manner that will pull us away from the financial stress that the organization has been experiencing. And lastly, Chair, around the funding model, is attention that we will be putting on two fundamental pillars thereof, which is managing the margins as well as managing the cash. So that's what this budget and strategy will seek to display. And as I've indicated earlier, whatever we do for us is about not doing it in a vacuum, but doing it in order to be exemplary in the environment in which we operate and audit. And hence, all of us, from being auditors to being supporting auditors, we are seeking to manage our risk, to manage our business, and manage our internal controls, transformation, and many other matters that will make this organization a model organization that is sought after to be the organization that people can relate to, an organization that people can see as a benchmark in the public sector. So those are the effectors and issues that are incorporated in this document, including the budget that accompanies it. And it's for all these issues that we then say, if we are to measure our reputation, which is the cornerstone of the final test of stakeholder recognition, this therefore should be how we inform and influence this reputation index. It's not going to drive itself, it's going to require an effort from our side, and this is the effort that we believe we need to put in all these five aspects that I've just highlighted, which forms the cornerstone of this document. And share with those few words, and I guess that analysis and context, that's the direction which we take the discussion through the Deputy AG. Give me thanks.
Thanks, AG. Thank you very much, AG. I think you've set the scene for what we're going to be dealing with during the course of today. And once again, also on my side, thank you very much to the Chair as well for assisting us to ensure that at least we managed to get a slot this week, short notice as it was. We thought that having spent the time that we did in putting this together, let's all try and get together and put it to bed as quickly as possible so that other things can also assume priority. Once we finish this, I'm sure there's going to be other priorities that we need to be engaging with. Chair, just at the beginning, I'm not going to go back to the strategy map that the AG has already covered,
most of the elements that the AG has spoken to are largely captured in our vision as set out on the slide. We've also, during the course of this year, in an effort to reinforce the key elements of our organization. Among them is the whole area of learning and growth of our people. We've taken that as one of the significant pillars that we are going to drive, which is incorporated in this strategy. We have also spent time dealing with the activities that we need to put in place to ensure that we strengthen the internal processes within the office. The financial environment has been spoken on at length. I'm going to deal with it and cover some of the critical issues that are given attention in the strategy document, as well as the core area in terms of our customer dimension. But I think one issue that I think I need to highlight as part of our plans for the next 3 to 5 years is really to focus on driving a values culture within the office. We've picked this up in a number of engagements that we've had throughout the country in all our offices, where our people said, what is the reason that we should be expected to want to pursue a career as auditors within the Auditor General? Because as we stand now, there is nothing that is a binding commitment in the form of values that we want to aspire to. And we felt that it's a worthwhile investment to listen to that feedback, as well as to translate that into a values program. And this is one of the key issues. If you look at those 6 bullets, these are pretty much the values that have been canvassed within the whole organization to say that there is something for everybody in being associated with the Auditor General. And this is part of our response to the ongoing challenges, among others, where we said there's a huge skills shortage within the office in terms of ability to attract auditors. But we think that if we give them something to aspire to, something to live for, it will probably assist us also in our ongoing effort to attract and retain talent. But beyond that, the vision of the organization, as well as its reputation promise, can only, even in the long term, be achieved if we have people who are demonstrating that they are prepared to perform at the levels where they are expected to. Because ultimately, in order to achieve our reputation promise, we need to ensure that we safeguard the quality of the work that we produce. And performance is going to be one of the key values that we will be driving in the office. The feedback we've been getting, among others, from our people has been that whenever they go out of their way to assist with the achievement of the objectives of the office, we never recognize them for that. Nor do we ever give them feedback to say they've done a good job. And we want to incorporate that, among others, as one of the key values that will drive what happens in the Auditor General, so that theirs is not only seen as the effort of an individual that ticked the existence of an invoice and moved on, but there should be something fundamental in the institution. And that's where a lot of the effort, as you will see in the detail, honorable members, we will be dealing with issues around leadership and growing our talent from within the organization. Just as a scene setter, I thought perhaps I'll just cover one or two of those critical values that the office will be focusing on. And in terms of the way we've developed the strategic plan document that you have in front of you, the key areas that we thought require specific focus are the ones which we've highlighted on the slide. Regularity audits, certainly that's a central pillar of what the institution is about. Over and above that, other things are there to reinforce fundamentally what we are about, which is the performance of regularity audits and reporting on the state of governance and financial administration within the public sector environment. We also deal in the document with the area of performance auditing and highlighting the key focus areas that we believe will make a difference in terms of executing performance audits and how we want to approach the area of performance auditing. There we will also deal with, once again, the phase-in program around the audit of performance information, which we've already been doing, and we're heading towards a time in the public sector where we would be expressing an opinion in 2010 thereabouts on the audit of performance information. We will deal in detail on that aspect as well. The funding model the AG has already covered. We've highlighted three key areas which we believe will assist us in sustaining the financial viability of the office. Leadership has also been highlighted as key among the things that will be top of mind and key focus areas, governance and reputation. On the regularity audit side, what we're dealing with in the document, Chair, is the ongoing effort to achieve unqualified reports and all the work that the office has been doing and that is continuing to do. And even with our corporate executives who are heading up our audit business units, they are currently engaged at an APEC conference and various other places where the focus is around what is it that we as an office need to do to ensure that we turn the tide with regards to the audit outcomes that we have become used to in the public sector. And there's an ongoing effort and ongoing focus around making sure that when we report on the audit outcomes, we focus on the issues that are relevant, the stuff that is going to make a difference, so that everybody who interacts with the financial information that is produced within government will understand what the root causes of opinions that are issued are. And we have invested a lot of time in making sure that these messages are going to begin to be embedded in the public sector in general. And it will assist in making sure that when solutions are sought for some of the difficulties that are encountered in the process of managing finances and enforcing governance, that the issue of root cause is not lost sight of. Again, we continue to pay a lot of effort around the timeous submission of financial statements to the office so that we can begin to produce the audit reports that are required within the time that is prescribed in legislation. An example among others, at the time that we signed off, for example, for the 07-08 financial year, on the 31st of July, when we issued our audit opinions after the audits were done, we have seen evidence that things are moving in the direction where they should be going. On the day, on the 31st of July, I think we signed off to the extent of 94% of BFMA audits. Those are audits that were done and signed with respect to the current year. So it just tells us that the focus that has been given around timeliness is assisting a great deal in ensuring that if there are issues that are contained in financial statements, they are not things that relate to 5 years ago. They are things that relate to the current period. And if any action has to be taken around fixing them by those who are charged with governance, they know that they are dealing with matters that occurred in the last 12 months, which we think is a very important development in terms of increasing the ability of departments nationally and provinces, increasing their capacity to report timeously and give feedback on the outcomes of their financial management. So that's continuing on our part to be a focus point, and certainly from the baseline that we have set ourselves for the PFMA, we are hoping to increase the overall timeliness measure by an additional 5% year on year. on the MFMA side, we've set that target low, and we are of the view that we need to have a look at it again, because there's a lot of effort that the AG in particular has put into visits within all the local municipalities immediately after we finished the roadshow on the MFMA results for 2006-2007. There's a huge focus that we've given to individual municipalities within provinces to make sure that they embrace the role that needs to be played by leadership in addressing financial management matters. We think that the target that we've set at 60% is potentially on the low side, and we are keen to have a look at that as well and make sure that at least insofar as the timeliness in local government, with all the backlogs of audits of municipalities having been cleared, it should not be difficult to set a target higher than what we got used to in the past. Chair, once again, also on the area of regularity audits, we want to make sure that the role that our own leadership in the office plays is not so much confined to doing audits and signing off on audits, but they should be the people who are engaging with the executive, who are engaging with legislatures across the country, and take that personal responsibility to make sure that insofar as the AG is concerned, issues are not left lying around for a long period of time, and they only become urgent once they have been brought to the attention of bodies like SCOPA and all of that. But we want them to be in front and engage and provide advice and inputs where necessary to various leadership in government, so that what comes forward to structures charged with governance is matters that are systemic in nature, that are not finding the right level of attention when they are supposed to be dealt with at departmental level. So those are the areas that we are going to be putting a lot more emphasis on, and is articulated very clearly in the document. Within the environment, also on regularity audits, the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors will continue to pay particular attention on the area of quality. The quality of audits that we produce is subjected to a test by the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors on an ongoing basis. We think that that approach must continue because it gives us the second option to make sure that where there have been failings in some of the audits that we do, that we can take the necessary action and deal with quality issues that might be creeping into our system in the office. If I step down on the regularity side, we've also had a look at the area of performance auditing, Chair, and said to ourselves, maybe as we begin to build capacity within the Auditor General on our performance audit dimension in terms of our core product, but certainly we need to be looking at developing an approach that says if performance auditing is going to work for us, we perhaps need to approach it from a sector point of view. We've put together a committee within the office to evaluate how best can we engage with the area of performance auditing. And we've gone through a number of options and came down to three focus areas that we believe are going to make an impact in the next 3 to 5 years. The one area that we think is going to be key is to perform performance audits in the education environment, whether it is performance audits on teachers, for example, performance audit on various aspects that inform education as a product. That's the area that we want to give attention to. And we've formulated and developed our budgets with that in mind. And we've taken a view that says the area of performance auditing within the office, as we were presenting earlier in the year on the difference between performance audit and audit of performance information, it became clear to us that we need to be treading carefully in this area, because this is one of the areas where if one looks at the three E's that we will be dealing with on performance audit, we're talking about the economy, the efficiency, and the effectiveness. And in the workshop that we had with the committee earlier in the year, we took on board the feedback that we were given around treading carefully on dealing with issues that might be interpreted to be commenting on policy, particularly where we have to evaluate the impact of some of the policies that are being implemented. So we are taking these sector focus areas with that understanding in mind to say that we probably will be better placed to focus on areas of economy, on areas of efficiency of expenditures that have been budgeted or put into some of these sectors. However, when it comes to areas of effectiveness, we need to have an understanding exactly as to what it is that we're commenting on, and we will be developing that internally on our side to make sure that we don't cause ourselves a strain with regards to our independence as the audit office. So that's insofar as the area of education, Chair, is concerned. And then in the area of consultants, what we're wanting to focus on here is, no doubt there are various permutations and various combinations of consultants that are used within the public sector. Some of them are necessary ingredients that come with the fact that we may not necessarily have all the skills. For example, the rehabilitation of large dams that sit within an environment like Department of Water Affairs and Forestry. You probably are dealing with an environment there where the usage of engineers who are supposed to look after the upkeep and maintenance of dams is a necessary part of what Water Affairs does, because they won't have those engineers in their payroll on an ongoing basis. However, there are other aspects of consulting services that are provided generally in the public sector which require certain levels of governance and certain practices to be in place to make sure that the best possible value for money is received when those consultants are being used. So we're going to be focusing on this area over the next 3 to 5 years to make sure that performance auditing from the office highlights some of the issues that might be causing either duplications or might be raised as red flags whereby consultants are used in addition to headcount that is also growing, and those type of considerations. So we want to get into this area to make sure that our performance audits can highlight and assist with how this whole area of consulting services is managed. And then the last one, which is another focus area under public, we call it public enterprises here, but it effectively relates to public entities that are managed within departments like public enterprises. There are public entities that sit, among others, within a department like communications, for example. You have in mind the likes of Centec, SABC and all of that. Then there are public entities in various departments that are housed to achieve certain objectives. And what you are saying here is that over the last while, when we also look at our own audit reports, when we look at what comes out in the public domain, there's no doubt public entities continue to have challenges with regards to issues of governance. What is the governance framework that is in place within public entities? Are they being governed in a manner that ensures that red flags are raised to highlight issues before they become massive problems? An example would obviously, among others, be Eskom environment. Are the proper systems and governance in place to ensure that if there are significant risks that are creeping into a particular public entity, that those risks are highlighted so that they can be brought to the attention of those who are managing and running those entities timeously? And we want to put our performance audit effort into that environment, because most of these public entities also are not audited directly by ourselves. But we believe that performance auditing could also enhance their ability to proactively identify issues of risk, issues of governance failure before they become critical. So those are the three areas, Chair, that we want to put in a lot of resources. And in doing this and in preparing our environment for gearing on this area, we decided internally that we are going to put our performance auditing environment under central control or coordination, which is sitting at head office. Previously, we used to have performance audit personnel in regions, and they were managed within their regions. But we've now decided, because we've now got very clearly articulated focus areas and we've developed a methodology around how we are going to do this work, we think that the skills that we have will probably be best utilized if the thinking and the thought leadership around performance auditing is sitting in one environment, and all the training that needs to be done is also done under the auspices of a centralized unit. We're lucky to secure for a limited period the services of the former Auditor General of Canada, who was an Auditor General in Canada up to 1991, a Mr. Day, who is currently within our environment in Pretoria, who is assisting our performance auditing team with a number of aspects of performance audit. He's a retired former Auditor General who has a limited contract with us to assist with the skills transfer aspect as well to our senior management. That is also paying off in the sense that we're beginning to compare how we would approach it on our environment with experiences that he has gained, among others, having worked in the environment in Canada. The ongoing research around the topics that we have identified is also a matter that we've given attention to, because we believe that for a performance auditing intervention, we need to have sufficient knowledge and insight into, for example, how do consultants get appointed, what gives rise to the need for them, and all of those things. And we're busy compiling sufficient information for ourselves so that we don't go to a particular department and say, you've spent 1.5 billion on consultants, but we have no understanding as to what it is that those consultants were supposed to do. Was it necessary? Was it not? And those are the issues that we are trying to go deeper into. We think that, Chair, once we have done our homework and once we've commenced with the initial assignments over a period of time, we will have performance auditing in the office that at least has grown from base zero, but has been given sufficient attention from a focus point of view, as well as the relevant skills that are required to execute this challenge. I guess when the international peer review that is planned to happen next year, when it happens, it will also give us additional insight where there are gaps in our performance auditing environment, because it's better that we subject ourselves to a peer review process, not because we want to score points, but because we want to identify from somebody else who has done this before, to help, so that that person can help us identify how best we can fix some of the things that we started doing which may not be adding value. So that's where the focus of that international peer review is going to be around. On the matter of audit of performance information, one thing to highlight is that we have engaged also with the Forum of South African DGs, FOSAT. We currently, on an ongoing basis, have slots within the governance and administration cluster of FOSAT, where we will be taking them through a workshop in the next meeting or so, where they will be focusing on understanding, you know, what our expectations are around audit of performance information. And it was quite encouraging, the last engagement we had, which was last week, where in one of their presentations, when they were dealing with the government-wide monitoring and evaluation system, they've highlighted the fact that we will be expected to express an opinion around 2010 on audit of performance information. And they have flagged that to their DGs to say, will you have all your controls in place by the time the Auditor General has to get ready to express an opinion? So we think those interactions are also assisting us in ensuring that the area of audit of performance information, when we have to express an opinion, is not a complete surprise to them. But this one is ongoing work, and we will continue in our annual reporting to do the audit of performance information from a point of view of satisfying ourselves with the key assertions around the audit of performance information, to assess its validity, to assess its accuracy, as well as to ensure that the rest of the information that we have audited in terms of the financial and regularity audit is not contradicted by what has been put into the annual report in terms of statistical information and so on. So that will continue to be the focus that we're giving to the area of audit of performance information. And as I said, there's a milestone that has been set for us to express an opinion around this from our honor about 2010. Chair, those are the key focus areas that we've identified, which are incorporated in the detailed strategic plan document with respect to the product element of our key strategic focus areas. And stepping down from that and perhaps moving into the funding and other initiatives, just as a reflection on the engagements that we've had in the last 3 to 4 months, we spoke at length and engaged on the funding of the office, and certain recommendations were made by the office with respect to lifting the cap on the tariffs that we are raising as an office. We've done that, and the budgets that we've populated, which are part of the strategic plan, incorporate the lifting of that cap. And we've seen, and I'll be going through another slide presentation after these few pages, where we have highlighted very specifically what the movements have been on the revenue line, as well as what the removing of the cap on our tariffs will do to our margins, as well as the net surplus that we are dealing with. Members will recall that in our positioning of the funding model, we spoke about moving our net surplus as a percentage of audit income to somewhere around 6%. We have not quite achieved that in terms of what we forecasting will happen in the next 3 to 4 years. And I guess there will be a greater amount of effort on our part to look more on the cost side, to try and see whether from that point of view we can perhaps look at moving things and structuring things differently, so that we can at least make sure that we get to the 5 or the 6% that we think will be a sustainable net surplus for the office. The other bits around the funding model relates, among others, to the collection of our debtors. It still continues to be a challenge, particularly within some local government areas. But most recently, some initiatives have gone into highlighting this issue with the highest levels of authority within the provinces, and we have been given some assurances that some relevant action will be taken to assist us in converting most of those debtors into cash. We continue to pursue those avenues as best we can, but there's no doubt that the issue of debt collection and managing our working capital will continue to be a point of focus for the next 3 to 5 years as well. Up to now, we have not implemented any last resort actions, whether it's to do with the writing off or whether it's to do with taking on our auditees, with those that know how to deal with people who don't pay. We haven't done that. We are busy exhausting all possible persuasive approaches. But we think that what is coming through now, particularly in some of the provinces where there's a high concentration of outstanding debt, we think that that is going to result in our money coming in, because we haven't previously spoken to the likes of Speaker and Premier. We've done it now, and I think at that level, we are getting some messages that say you will be assisted in whatever way possible. On the vacancies front, Chair, I'm not going to go into the detail. We've canvassed this issue very in as much detail in the document. Suffice to say that the assumptions that we have built into our funding and in our budget are largely going to rest on how successful we are with improving the vacancies situation. Where we were the previous year compared to where we are now with regards to the vacancies, we think that the middle layer, which is the managers as well as the assistant managers, there are some improvements that have come through in that regard. We've decided, as we indicated to the committee previously, to seek offshore assistance with respect to beefing up this area. That program, which we shared with the committee in terms of the arrangement that we are going to enter into with Deloitte, where they were going to assist us with sourcing managers and assistant managers from their India practice, that program is now being implemented. We are expecting the first batch of those secondees in the next 2 weeks. Many of them have already gone through the screening and the interviewing process, and they will be on shore in 2 weeks' time, and we will be putting them into about 4 of our provinces where the greater level of vacancies has been experienced. the focus around this is very clear to us. One, there's two aspects to it. The aspect of continuing to have managers that assist with the delivery of the audit product, as well as having managers who are going to assist us with transferring skills to our trainee accountants, because we've got this whole batch of trainee accountants who are going through a 3-year cycle, but because of the ongoing vacancies at managerial level, they come through their 3rd year without adequate supervision and training. Those are some of the issues that we are experiencing with the difficulty to retain them, because what they experience over the 3 years of their training is an environment where very little supervision, if you compare it to what happens in private audit firms, there's very little of that comes to them. We think that this gap, once we filled it with these numbers of people, it's not a huge numbers of people, certainly we're looking at a first batch of around 15 or 20, but they'll be spread into various provinces to deliver on the audits as well as to assist with the training on the job of our trainee accountants. And that program, as we indicated previously, Chair, is a term intervention. None of those people who will be seconded will be here for longer than 24 months. It ranges between 12, 18 and 24 months, depending on individuals that are coming onto it. And then there's a couple of other initiatives which, in their nature, are medium to long term in terms of the impact that they will make. But certainly we're saying to ourselves, maybe there's another area to look at, and that is the schooling environment. We've already started initiatives there. We call them corporate social investment initiatives, but certainly they are our target across the country, where we've identified about 15 high schools that we will engage with on an ongoing basis to whet the appetite of the students, those that are doing mathematics, and encourage them to consider Auditor General as an option from a career point of view. There are issues that come with it. Obviously, the AG will consider, for those that are interested and real, demonstrate real interest, to consider giving them bursaries and providing them the training environment once they complete their studies within the office. So those are some of the issues that we think in the long term they will continue to assist the office to secure consistent supply of talent, which is seriously lacking in many respects because of challenges within the supply side on the labor front. Even the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants has flagged this as one of their top risks, one of their top 10 risks, the issue of continuing to grow and develop talent. They've estimated that the people who will be writing the board exam in the next 5 years or so will be much less than what they got used to in the past. Among others, it's to do with the fact that there's a shrinkage with regards to people who are numerically inclined in terms of their high school studies and all sorts. So we are not going to give up on that issue, because we believe that if the office will continue to deliver on its reputation promise, it will need people who are developed in the local environment, who understand the PFMA, who have been trained on the MFMA, and who generally understand how government auditing is done. And that's where the leadership of the office is also going to come from, because without that, and without the effectiveness that we are trying to drive within our leadership environment, a lot of these initiatives will fall flat, because we think that people, when they come into organizations, they join the organizations, but when they leave the leaders that are leading them, if they think that they are not the right quality of people to lead them. That's where the leadership effectiveness focus is coming from, to continue to develop the capacity of our leaders to take their responsibility of driving culture within the organization as one of the issues that are top of mind, so that the rest of the work that they have become accustomed to do can be delegated to those that can deliver on the technical side of things. And then two last issues, Chair, which are also a focus point for the office, which are incorporated and articulated in the document, is the area of governance and risk management. AG has already shared with us some of the critical issues that are required from an institution that must lead by example. we will continue to address the area of governance and risk management, so that what we started beginning of this year when we looked at our finance turnaround plan continues to be entrenched in the environment. We want to continue to improve our processes, particularly within the area of human capital, the area of finance, and the area of information and communication technology, to improve the maturity levels of those processes to a level where we can feel comfortable that the likelihood of our environment achieving a qualified audit report becomes more and more remote. That's really the focus, and we think that if governance and risk management is what we are going to be preaching out there, we rather do it ourselves first. And then lastly, on the strategic document, Chair, as the AG also highlighted in his introduction, all of these initiatives that we are highlighting in the strategic plan are geared towards ensuring that our reputation continues to improve. And the only way that we would be able to identify what impact an improvement on our reputation is doing is when our audits and our audit reports are understood by a broader base of the public, as well as if they are making a meaningful contribution to the state of financial administration and governance in the public sector. We would be able to then say that we think that our reputation as an audit institution has improved, and a lot of these efforts are geared towards coming to that conclusion, and we think that there will be a lot of challenges that will come our way as we attempt to implement this strategic plan, but we believe that the focus that we've given to those six elements in terms of the key focus areas are likely to have a more significant impact. Chair, that is the detail pertaining to the key focus areas of the strategic plan in the office. And what I'd like to do next for, say, 15 minutes is to quickly go through some of the financial highlights that are incorporated in the document, because I think the attempt is to assist members of the committee in the next couple of weeks to engage with this document with a level of understanding of where the key drivers are with regards to what is incorporated in the numbers. And then I'll leave it.
Excuse me, Mr. Makweto. I do not know whether we can say for the next 10 minutes ask questions for clarity on what has been presented already. Not for purposes of coming to a conclusion, because this meeting is not intended for that, but for us to be able to digest this information and be in a position then to make meaningful proposals at a meeting designed for that. Our fellow members with me there, I wanted just us to have questions of clarity, and then for the next 10 minutes, and then after 10 minutes, then we can go on. Now it seems that we do not have any questions for clarity, then we can go on with the program.
I'm going to be very quick on this one, Chair. As I said, I think there probably will be another opportunity to engage also on this detail, I think, once members have applied themselves to some of the detail. The budget assumptions that we've put into the model that we used in developing the budget, as I indicated earlier, was based on lifting the cap, primarily in terms of ensuring that we bill the right amount of audit income that we in the past have not been billing because of the cap that we put into our tariffs. We've also recognized the fact that from a recovery of audit fees point of view, that means the hours recoverable from available hours at an individual level need to go down, because for a long time the office has been pushing product, but we haven't given sufficient attention to the learning and growth side of things, and we've basically reduced the recovery percentage so that there's a fair balance between what we generate as income as well as what we provide people time to go and learn and grow, and so that they can continue to see the office as an environment where their own growth and development is encouraged, and that they can also aspire to positions in the office that in the future will assist them to grow in their career. So there's a balance that we've created in our budget, and it's largely driven by those two factors. Where we've basically moved from an average recovery of 70% and lowered it at the senior levels. And I've got a slide which indicates how the available hours compare to what we invest in training and development, among others. Largely because I think also we are a training office that has been accredited by the Institute of Chartered Accountants, by SAIGA, and various other institutes as an environment where people can be trained and developed. And that's where this recovery percentage reduction is coming from. On the next slide, in terms of the projected income statement, Chair, the top columns at the top, if I can just start with explaining those ones. The first one is obviously the end of the year that we've just finished in March 2008. Followed by what our forecast to the end of March 2009 is. Those first 2 years in the income statement are the years where our revenue still has the cap of 4% on senior people. And the way this cap has worked and has disadvantaged us in terms of creating a margin that is sustainable to fund the activities of the office is that all the people that grow into the environment, once they reach the particular level in terms of their earnings, their fee income starts slowing down because it's kept at a rate of about 4%. So we have not really been able, and we indicated when we submitted the funding model that up to the year 2008, that cap has affected about 44% of our revenue that we were technically supposed to be generating from their services. So the first 2 years, as you would see, are operating at a gross margin of audit income of 25%, almost consistent. The year that we've just finished, which has been audited, as well as the year that we are on now, we are projecting that the margin that will be generated from our activities, which is at the bottom on the page, is about 25%. Now, the next 3 years, which is the budget, 2010, 2011, 2012, the margin, because of lifting that cap, has now improved to somewhere above 30%. And we believe that once our margins start moving in the 30-odd percent range, then it gives us a sense of comfort that we will be in a position to fund the ongoing activities of the office. Because the 25%, even our audit committee has indicated that we're probably operating at a level which is far low, even compared to the audit firms that we are giving work to. So the impact of this in terms of the revenue line has resulted in our revenue projections for this 2010 budget growing from just 1.37 to about 1.7 billion. And a large portion of it, as I said, is that 44% of potential revenue which we were not bringing into our income because of the capping. So that's effectively really what I thought. And then everything else that we have, if it's driven by headcount in terms of our costs, we always keep it within the levels that we believe our costs will be sustainable. But the detailed income statement that has got all the split in terms of the specific items is contained in the strategy plan document, and so if members wanted to look at it. But I thought the major shift from a strategic point of view in terms of our finances was the lifting of the cap, and that's why we're starting to see a growth in the revenue line, as well as the margin, obviously, which we believe will be sustainable. be moved on the slide. Over here, yeah, that one. No, I don't have anything to say on that one, just move it on. And just a quick commentary on the overhead, on the increase in overheads, Chair. A large portion of that is a growth in the support services area. What we've done there, when we picked up that a lot of this growth is coming from headcount, we decided that we are going to put in a measure in place to make sure that we don't grow the headcount and support services beyond a level that is reasonable. So we have put in a measure in place already there, whereby if we are to employ people in corporate services, the chief operations officer will be the person who makes sure that there is general agreement in the whole of the leadership in the office about the need in the first instance for those heads, because we believe that there's a lot that we can achieve if we combine our existing resources with our existing people to do the work that needs to be done. So that growth in the support services is probably in the budget, but we are of the view that once we put the necessary controls in place, we may not necessarily have the need to spend those monies increasing headcount in the support areas. That's what I was referring to earlier when I mentioned that if we don't get to achieve that 6% net surplus from the growth in the revenue, we'll find it in the maintenance and control of the costs side. And then the next slide on the audit income movement is just a demonstration, Chair, of the comparison between this year that we are forecasting and the following year in terms of the recoverable hours. In total, for this budget year, we're looking at about 2.4 million hours across the whole office that we are going to be using to generate the income for the office. And the comparison to contract work is contract work hours roughly of about 1 million. We think that the split between the two, the budget year as well as the current forecast year, is still consistent, because as soon as we make the necessary inroads in managing our vacancies, it will be important that the contract work is maintained at the levels that we've come used to. And then the net surplus currently in terms of the forecast for the 2009 year is currently in a negative situation, as I indicated earlier, because of the funding issues. But that situation for 2010 going forward will sit at around 4% and 5%. And I think the ongoing challenge for us is to hit the 6% that we said ideally we would like to be at. We will develop the necessary plans, and I'm sure in due course we'll share with SCOWEC what those plans specifically are, which will assist us in getting to the 6%. A lot of it is going to be around growing our own talent. As soon as we are able, in terms of what I spoke about earlier regarding the reduction of the vacancies, sourcing talent and bringing our own heads on board, once we have our own people and we are able to reduce the contract work, then it means if we are delivering that work ourselves, we are able to earn a margin on it. Whereas on the contract work side, we basically are a conduit between the audit firm and the auditee, because they bill us 1 million rands, we collect on their behalf, and we give it to them as is. So there's no margin for us in that relationship. So if we can maintain that contract work to a level lower than it is, it'll give us the opportunity to utilize our own people who will earn a margin. And hopefully that margin, if it's across a broad base of people in various business units, will contribute towards achieving this 6%. And that's why the next bullet becomes also linked and critical in terms of that, to say, in developing and retaining our key skills is another attempt at making sure that a margin or a net surplus as a percentage of audit income is achieved. Because our people, if they are recoverable, and we are recovering them at an average of about 70%, on available hours, they are able to generate that surplus for themselves. And then obviously the introduction of control measures to reduce the escalation of overhead costs is another area of emphasis. On this one, Chair, we just extracted the slide to say that, yes, we are focusing on the one side on generating the revenues to fund the activities of the office so that we can continue to enhance our ability to be independent from a finance point of view, even though that may not necessarily be the full independence that we strive to achieve, but at least if we are able to have an arm's length relationship from a fee income point of view, that helps. However, the critical element that the office is also focused on is the whole area of training. And here what we are demonstrating is the total hours that we have built in this budget, which are for training activities. And the bulk of it, as I indicated earlier, is predominantly the middle management layer and the trainee accountants who we have contracted with to provide training to them. This is over and above the on-the-job training. This is training to develop soft skills, to develop skills on various aspects of their training in the office. And managers and senior managers alike, we have built in a lot of training hours which are in addition to the cash cost of training. These are just the hours that we give them, which we don't necessarily earmark to bill our clients. And then on top of that, we obviously spend on some of the training if we have a service provider who comes and deliver training. So we think that the balance needs to continue to be maintained. We're talking about an average per person of about 455 in the office. And if we wanted to monetize those hours, we could, I don't know what that answer will be, but it will basically be 510,000 hours of training and development at 455 rand on average. That's the value associated with this investment in training and development of our people. And then the last slide, Chair, is just a demonstration of what the capacity shortfall in our office does to our margins. And here we've got a total budget of 2,476 hours. Not that one, but two. The capacity shortfall slide is the last one. Haven't got it. We've got copies of the. Oh, we do have. Don't have a copy of that. It's not on the thing there. This page. It's not on that page. Maybe let me just talk to the issue in principle as to what we're trying to highlight here. What we're saying is that the total hours that we have budgeted for the 2010 budget year is currently at about 2.4 million hours. What we are saying is that if our vacancy situation deteriorates and we did not succeed in the effort to fill the vacancies, the impact that will have on our margin is huge, because for every additional head that we are not succeeding to bring in based on the model that we developed in terms of the budget assumptions, the revenue that we were hoping to get is obviously lost permanently. Rather, the margin is lost permanently. And therefore, we've got to replace those people that we hoped to recruit with contract work. And as I said, contract work comes at no margin to us. So this slide, which seemingly is going to be getting back, was just demonstrating what the impact of that is going to be if we assume that we exceed our capacity shortfall by 20%, or if our shortfall in terms of the capacity is reduced by 20%. I was just demonstrating in terms of the numbers how sensitive this budget is to the fact that if we don't make a success on vacancies, we could blow out quite a significant amount of money from the margins. But if it comes up, I'll probably just show the numbers only. But in principle, that's really what that last slide was supposed to say. In essence, and in conclusion, it basically then says to us, if anything has to come right in terms of what we are developing in this budget, we need to make sure we pay particular attention to we need to make sure that we pay particular attention to succeeding on the vacancy filling. And I think we've been sharing that message quite a lot with the committee. What we have there is the total recoverable hours, which are contained in the budget document, the 2.476 million hours. Currently, we are running at a capacity shortfall of 8.2%. So if we say that shortfall of 8.2% increases by 20%, then that shortfall becomes 9.84%. And therefore, the hours that are lost due to the shortfall will be 2.4 million multiplied by the 9.84, which is about 270,000 hours that are lost, at an average rate per hour of 455, which is our broad average in terms of the hourly rates, will be own hours income that sacrificed of somewhere around 122. So we can see that if the vacancy assumption that we've worked with in this model goes the other way, there's a huge impact on the numbers that it has. And that's why for us the key focus will be to make sure that insofar as the filling of vacancies, particularly at managerial and assistant manager levels, must continue, and we must make sure that we make a success of it. And we've just applied the gross profit percentage factor there to determine what gross profit we will sacrifice if our vacancy assumption is missed. So that table basically takes into account a situation where our shortfall increases as well as when it goes down by 20% as well, just to demonstrate what the impact is on both sides of the... The break-even, we haven't worked it out, but I'm sure we can populate that assumption. We want to be above it. That, in a nutshell, Chair, was just the highlight of the numbers, so that at least when we read them, at least we put in that context to them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. When you say questions for clarity, can we ask anything about the strategic plan and budget that we've discussed, that we've been...
Yes, up to so far, yes.
So there can be more substantive than just questions of clarity.
Yes, as long as it clarifies, okay, and makes it easier for us to make a decision and a proposal later.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I must say, I suppose like all of my colleagues on the committee, one feels that it's something of a disadvantage. The meeting seemed to be sprung on us, and I only got my documents yesterday, so I felt a bit underprepared. But, you know, one does understand there's been a change in chairperson, and we lost Mr. Peterson, our secretariat, so we're going to have to just muddle through. But if some of my questions are not too clever, just forgive me. I started going through this document and just had a few issues, some which are of clarity. I suppose the big question is, when we went through this exercise last year, we looked at the strategic plan, we looked at a budget, and during the course of the year, the wheels fell off. So it would seem that the essential risk assessment part of your strategic planning, we underestimated certain issues last year, and then they caught up with us. Looking at the risk issues you highlight this year, I don't really see that jumping out at me saying what would be the risks of us not dealing with some of those problems. It looks like we've dealt with part of the problem by lifting a certain cap, which means we could be accommodating in our budget the problem that existed in the current year in order not to get into another 34 million loss situation. But I'm just wanting to know that during your strategic planning exercise and on the risk assessment side, did you apply your minds very carefully to, you know, what happens if you don't collect, if you don't improve on your debtor collection situation, what if it goes worse? Because the type of indicators you gave this morning don't form me with great confidence that through this provincial initiative you are suddenly going to start changing your debtors into cash. So have we really thought that through, or is that still a major risk area? What happens if it does get worse? How is that accommodated in your risk management plan? Likewise with issues of staffing. Likewise with your intention to arrest the contract hours. This contract hours thing has been going on for, you know, 15 years that I've been here. It's a product of market forces, of supply and demand. I know we take lots of initiatives, and one always compliments the office for trying to be creative, but I think there's still a risk there. So I just want to know that you really addressed those, and that those somehow are reflected in your strategic plan beyond what one reads here. If I could stop there at this point, because I think that's quite central. There are some minor little issues of clarity I'd like to come back to you if you give me the opportunity later on. Thank you.
Okay, Chairperson, as long as we are going to stick to our 10 minutes so that they finish their presentation, no doubt.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for, and thanks to the Auditor General's Office for the presentation. On page 6 of the strategic plan and budget, there are key sectors that are identified for performance auditing, and whilst one acknowledges the independence of the office, but the department, or in fact the government, has identified education as its focus, health as well, and crime prevention. Here it is education, which we appreciate, consultation and public enterprises, and one will want to know as to whether at some stage we are going to see departments such as health being identified as key sectors for performance auditing, so that maybe the office is assisting government in realizing its objectives of prioritizing these entities or these departments. Probably my other question will be on the area of capping. My question will be to say, how are we going to ensure that there is no abuse if we remove capping, as the Office of the Auditor General is suggesting, and that is, we are expected to play an oversight role. How are we going to know that it is not abused, and how are we going to monitor that? I just wanted to ask those few questions. Thank you.
Mr. Masawa, you'll be the last in this phase.
So, Chairperson, I can take the rest of the 8 minutes that is left.
The rest of the two.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I just want to do a follow-up and additional query on the removal of capping, not specifically to that alone, but I wanted to check as to whether the Office of the Auditor General has not thought of giving us options or maybe giving us some projections to say, if this doesn't happen, this will be the picture. If I can just make an example, that if we would not remove that capping and we don't agree on that one, what would be the situation? I'm looking at their proposed budget, and to me it says there's nothing else except that they've, what they're presenting to us is in terms of what they think would be the best to deal with the situation. But if in case we may not agree on that, for instance, just if we say we're not going to remove the tariff, the capping, what could be, what they could be faced with as a, as an office? That's the first one. The second one is probably, if we can take into the equation the collection of debt that is outstanding and bring it in, because I'm not sure on their proposed budget, are they including that? If you talk about retention of 6% surplus, is it also taken into account of a surplus that might increase because of probably being able to collect the long-term debt over that has been accumulating over the years? Is it taken into account in their projected income and so as the surplus? Thanks, Chair.
Okay, over to you, Office of the Auditor General. Crime, health, working capital, debt.
Chair, I'm just going to deal with one or two, and then I'll pass on to Wally Van Yarden and the rest of the team to add on others. I'm going to deal quickly with the last one, the one that says what would happen if we did not remove the cap, and as well as the issue of the options that we would perhaps have to make available. When we presented the funding model, we presented it with this as one of the options. The other option that we put on the table was also the option to say, how about getting funding directly from Parliament? That was one of the options that we put on the table. So in the engagement that took place in the committee, there was a feeling that emerged which said that maybe one of the options that have been presented, the one on looking at removing the cap, will probably be the one that will keep you in the safe in terms of approach. So we did present the option. So we're coming back here with having had that engagement. So this presentation of this budget is saying we came and this was the feeling, and then we went to prepare our budgets on that understanding. If the capping was not removed, what would happen? Clearly, I think the issue of the capping is a historical thing that emerged, I don't know how many years ago, where we said to make audit fees relatively affordable for government, we should not be growing the rates that we're charging to government at what CPIX, for example, or thereabouts is, because what we're experiencing now is whilst we have this cap, the rest of the other costs that we have to incur to continue to do what we have to do are growing at rates higher than that 4%, which means that our ability, among others, to attract the right skills into the office is seriously impacted, because we can only offer people what we believe will be generated from the fees that we charge. So already that is a big challenge, which says if you continue to keep the cap the way it is, you're going to continue to make losses, and therefore there will be no appetite for you to even have the capacity to want to retain people that want to go to your competitors, because your competitors' rates are growing at what they consider to be market-related increases. So they are able to increase their fees and poach your own staff. But once they've done that, they then also come back and get the contract work from you. So effectively, without being able to protect your turf, in essence, I'm not saying that it will be protected only by removing the cap, but I think one of the implications is that the ability to have to be able to attract talent is going to be seriously impacted if we don't do anything about it. And I guess I think it also has to be looked at in the context of we are not removing this cap to make more money, in essence, in terms of, you know, wanting to make profit, but we are removing it to make sure that the balance between what we earn and what we spend is maintained. On the worry, I think the risk issues.
Can I come on this? Sorry, just on the issue of the removal of the cap as well, it's also important that having engaged SCOWEC on this matter extensively, the only pending issue was the formal confirmation from Treasury that they support the model. And to that extent, we have received indeed an indication of support. They're just evaluating the last bits of our proposal, and it looks like they're likely to remove the aspect of debt collection from that model for us to pursue that on our own, but they're going to be supporting the issue of the margins. Hence, our assumptions are based on the margins being packed at the level at which we have actually put them here without the cap, because that's the understanding that Treasury has of this. We just need to be getting a formal confirmation of that. So that's the basis of us going this direction. And anything short of that is going to take us back to our annual embarrassing situation where we have to come back here every time and talk about having made a loss. And I think we've dealt with that thing substantially and substantively by saying the root of this loss is this cap, and the root of the cap is the fact that we cannot retain and attract people. And the fact that we cannot retain and attract people puts us in a vulnerable position where we've got to do work with the input costs that are beyond our means.
Thank you, Chair. I think the risks that was identified by Dr. Woodsworth is real risks, and we have a great appreciation for that comment. But if I can, just for this year, for the interim that we've started now, just comment on what has been done by the AG. I think, first of all, on debtors, we know that 44% of our debtors that are older than 80 days is in the area of local government. Now, with the initiative that the AG has taken to visit all the provinces and specifically interact with the MEC for local government, the MEC for finance, the Premier, and even the speakers, we have, as part of the presentation that we make to these individuals or stakeholders, we indicate what is the situation with debtors. And we have seen now that already, like in the case of Free State, we have had a result in that the MEC for local government has paid us the full amount in respect of those local government or those municipalities which could not pay in the past. And that is already a positive move towards getting those debtors paid by the province. There is a slight technicality in terms of whether the local MEC local government can pay for all those municipalities, but for the interim, we have overcome that by by asking National Treasury also to look at the way of means on how those amounts can be reflected in the various municipalities' books, even though it's paid by the MEC local government. It is a critical area, because it's not as if you can take that money from the conditional grants that the municipalities get, because the constitution doesn't allow that. So we're quite aware of that risk, and we've put in an extensive effort now by the provincial BEs for them to interact at a much higher level in getting those monies from the municipalities. Also, the mayors and the executive mayors are also consulted on a regular basis. So we believe we're going to have a positive influence in terms of collecting those debtors. In terms of the vacancies, I think that's also a real risk. But what we have in the meantime started to do is...
Can we just try and as he continues on this specific one about the first aid as an example, understandably so. So just a quick rider, if it is possible, can I?
Yes, as long as it is going to be short.
No. The issue for me would be more about the sustainability of such. What happens next time the municipalities are not? Were you able to conclude on those specific ones with the first aid MEC? What happens next when the municipalities are not able to pay?
Chair, through you, I think in terms of the interaction with the MEC for local government, which is now going to be on a continuous basis, we'll also be getting the support from the MEC for local government to apply some pressure on these municipalities in order for them to pay the Auditor General. So there's going to be greater interactive between us, the MEC for local government, and the relevant municipality who owes us that money. So the interaction is going to increase far beyond the interaction that we used to have in the past. And as I said, that is a positive result from the AG's roadshows that we've had now with the provincial department, as well as the municipalities that has been visited up to now.
Just a quick addition to this, Chair, and maybe covering one of the questions that was... the quick one, I think one of the issues I think I'd like to highlight here is that we obviously do this credit, these audits effectively on credit, because we are advancing credit to the municipality. We pay for the salaries, we pay for all our costs prior to them paying us, even the ones that pay timeously. Now, obviously, the one fundamental risk within the credit life cycle is the fact that you may not get your money once you go and collect it. And in the life cycle of that debt, probably what we are doing more and more towards the end is the persuasion. But I think ultimately for any debt, its life cycle ends with the person that owes the debt being taken on through the legal environment where they have to be forced to pay. And I guess the issue perhaps which we probably need to look at is to say, within the environment in which we audit, do we have the capacity to take that last step, because that's the necessary step that gets to be taken by anybody who advances credit to somebody else? And I think perhaps that's the question, because we've almost preferred the option that says, because we are auditors in government, maybe the best possible approach is to continue to persuade, because we've got a relationship that we have with our auditees where persuasion can probably be effective. But if it's not effective, I think the question that probably we need to be thinking about is, like any debt grantor, what must we do? Must we enforce it through taking what the PAA provides in terms of, you know, charging interest and then taking legal steps and so on? Maybe that's what we haven't engaged with, Chair. And I think, quite frankly, in the full cycle of the life cycle of a debt, that's probably one thing that we haven't even ventured into. And maybe, if I'm reading that question, because I think that question has been raised a number of times whenever we engage with the issue of the funding of the office, I just wanted to get a sense as well, you know, whether it is the expectation that we need to take the debt issue to its logical conclusion. I think that's really the gap that we have been missing all the time, and maybe we need to take that feedback if that's what the committee is suggesting, among others.
Excuse me, just 1 minute. There was a question around key sectors for transversal performance auditing over and above the three that are listed on page 6 of the presentation. That was crime and crime prevention and healthcare, that the performance around those. Where is it exactly on your timeline?
Chair, in looking at the key focus areas in terms of the transversal audits that we're proposing to do on performance audits, we did look at the total picture to start with, including health, including crime prevention and various others. But then we said to ourselves, the reality is that when it comes to capacity and ability to deliver on those, many of those we will struggle. For obvious reasons, because it will require quite a lot of expertise in addition to our own, you know, orientation that we have as possibly auditors or accountants to be able to deal effectively with all the three E's in performance audit on a vast field like crime prevention and health and all of those things. We haven't lost sight of them, we've engaged and debated on them, but felt that with our limited resources and what we would need to source in a big area like education, potentially we would be able to handle it. But when it comes to doing performance audit on things like consultants and governance within public entities, we do have that expertise internally because we do these audits mostly on the regularity front, so we can be able to handle that. So I think if it were not for the fact that our performance audit unit has not grown over a period of time up to now, we probably would be able to take the risk in terms of, you know, expanding our reach to those areas. But I think it will be too complex as a start to deal with that. I think it was more a case of, can we do it with the available resources? And knowing that in the broader market, the recruitment of accountants to start with for regularity audits is a challenge. Well, how much more when we would be expected to deal intelligently with a vast field as health, among others, for example. So those were the issues that we looked at. And then we said, maybe because of their size and complexity, these ones must be put aside. Maybe there are other interventions, whether they are coming from analyses that are done by the Public Service Commission, the Presidency, and various other units in government that engage with those issues on an ongoing basis from a performance audit point of view. So we felt, for those reasons, it probably will probably take a pet pen.
Thank you.
If I may just conclude on the previous question as well, in terms of on vacancies, which Dr. Woods has referred to, I think what we have at the moment is, and the committee has given input on that on a previous occasion, on the RGA route, that is the Registered Government Auditors, we have accreditation for SAIGA. Last year we had 103 people that qualified in terms of the scheme. This year we've got another, I think, 96 people that are enlisted or enrolled on the scheme. So those individuals coming off that scheme will also be filling some of the vacancies that we have at manager level. We also embarked on, and it's in the document, we're also appointing clerks which are not fully qualified and which will also be able to generate income in terms of their duration in the office, and we're thinking of encouraging them on to go on to qualify further on. So that is a further income. And as the AG has indicated, the Deloitte project, we believe it's going to create further stability within the training accountant scheme for them to qualify and also come through the processes. We've also this year looked at the salary differentiation between the people that have got CPA and Board 1 and Board 2. We've brought the salary scales in line so we can utilize these people earlier and encourage them to stay on into the in the office. So we believe that's also going to create some further potential people for our vacancy. So overall, I think if you take that into account, and also a project that we have in terms of looking at what audits we can take back, we refer to it as the Section 4.3 project, we believe that we could have further, we could generate further income by creating more opportunities for the business units. We've created two new business units in the AG, which is now starting to provide results in terms of further income and reducing the contract work allocation. So we're quite confident that we are going to achieve success and reduce the risks that you've identified. But I mean, it's a question of time. We'll have to look at it again towards the end of the financial year.
Thank you, Mr. Van Heerden. And let us have Advocate Stevens, then Ms. Jabavu. And then perhaps let us consider taking a break for about 10 minutes, have a finger lunch, and then aim at about 2 o'clock to terminate our meeting, because I think you have managed your time in a particular way.
Thank you, Chair. I think H. Nkimi will remember that I've suggested this before as far as the debtor problem is concerned. It's one of your major problems, and it's not something that you can sweep under the carpet. It is a very inescapable culmination, as you've said, of giving credit, is that eventually you've got to take into account enforcing it by means of the law. Not that I'm suggesting that your office should become a major litigant in the courts of South Africa, because that's never a good policy. So in other words, what I'm saying is that I want to suggest that you seriously consider bringing that in. In other words, suing and going to court. Bringing that in as a definite part of your program of debt collection. It becomes a part of that. And that obviously would also include a provision in your budget for legal costs. I'm not sure what your situation would be with the state attorney's office. They would probably not charge you the same as an outside attorney's office. I don't know. But A, it would be necessary to take that on, find out exactly what it is. But there are other implications as well. And that is how you operate with your clients. Because, and this is something that I want to recommend that you discuss all of this long before taking any action, before going into an audit. You discuss this with the state attorney's office, is that you need some documentation to make sure that when you claim, that when you actually need to go to court at the end of the day, you have a liquid claim and not an illiquid claim. And that requires certain documentation. In other words, because you're not acting on a contract, you're acting in terms of the law. You don't have a contract with your people as an ordinary firm does. You're acting in terms of the Constitution. So I would suggest that you, that all these legal points are cleared up beforehand, so that if it ever becomes necessary to take a particular department or whatever to court, you have a liquid claim that is ready, for that is the fastest and the cheapest way of getting a judgment. If you have an illiquid claim and you have to lead evidence in every case of how many hours we spent, you know, what the outstanding queries are, blah, 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 and there are all sorts of excuses that you can use in litigation. That's why you want a liquid claim. I would suggest that it's very important that sooner rather than later you discuss this with them and set up your whole way of working in such a way that if it should at the end of the day become necessary, you are ready, able, with all the documentation, go to court in the shortest and cheapest possible way. But I agree, it should only be a matter of last resort. The way that you've been doing it is the right way. Thank you.
Chair, I agree fully with the sentiments. We have, but as the DAG has said, there's also this relationship problem that we're experiencing at ground level between the senior manager and the auditee. We, for instance, also had a test case during the last 2-3 months where we asked, for instance, the KZN province to enforce the letter of demands to the fullest. And the success rate that we had with that province was tremendous. I mean, we've and Raj is the accounting the CFO, you will actually confirm that. So I think it was a bit of a situation where the senior managers that were in charge of the audits didn't want to apply fully the letter of demand policies that we have, because going back to a client the next time, the relationships are a bit fractured in a way, if you can call it that way. So I agree fully that in terms of our documentation that we have, in terms of what is the audit fee, what was the hours, what was approved by the audit committee, what was accepted, but we have all that on record. Now it's a case of formalizing it in terms of legal grounds, and I think that would be the last resort, as you say. But we've had great success, as I said, now with the letters of demand, and we're encouraging the senior managers to follow that route. So we quite confident that we might be getting some results in that as well.
The last one is Mr. Bavu, then we break for about 10 minutes for a finger lunch.
So my comment is going to be around the issue that was raised around staffing as a risk. And I just wanted to add to Wally's comment to say, before we went on to a strategic planning session, we scanned the external environment. We looked at the market's labor turnover rate. And I think the labor turnover rate that we used this time around was more realistic compared to last year. What we also did was to compare our salaries with the external environment. Late last year, we also went through roadshows that were headed by the Deputy Auditor General, which identified most of the issues in the internal environment. And hence the interventions that we came up with in this current year and the initiatives that we have for the coming year. So we think that we realize that staffing is a problem, the vacancy rate is a problem, but I think the interventions that we have come up with will go a long way in terms of addressing the issues that we're sitting with.
Thank you. Let us break for about 10 minutes, have our finger lunch, and come back at about quarter past, please. Thank you. And then perhaps the detail. We can confront in the next meeting when we deliberate towards a conclusion. Are the names listed in the program not going to follow? What is the arrangement? The program is the presentation finished? Okay. No, what was confusing was we had the names, but there was the issue of the external audit of the office. I don't know whether it has been finalized or it is about to be finalized. If perhaps we can get a briefing on that.
Chair, it has not been finalized. There is a request from the chair of the audit committee to have a meeting with SCOAC to discuss the way forward in terms of appointing new external auditors. We went out on tender, as you will recall, and the response was very poor. Only two firms responded. One was from Cape Town, and the other one was the one that we have, BDO. And unfortunately, none of them met the criteria that we had set out. But the chair of the audit committee is desirous of meeting, you know, with this committee so that we can discuss the way forward and see what can be done.
Dr. Woods.
It's just a small issue, Chair. If we were to relax that stipulation that suggested that any audit company that got work from the office wasn't allowed to, wasn't that a quote? If we were able to get through around any conflicts of interest situation, do you think that would have made a difference to the number of applicants?
Probably. But I'm not 100% certain because of the, you know, of the amount of fees, you know, for this kind of work compared to the other work, you know, in which they've got an interest and where they would like to utilize their resources. So I'm not quite sure, but maybe for small B companies it might. I really don't know.
Yeah, in fact, yeah, the problem now is here that if you become an external audit of the Auditor General, you are excluded from the contract, and therefore now as a business, is it a wise decision to audit for the Auditor General if you get excluded from the other services? I don't know. That is the decision we've got to that's a factor we've got to look into.
Sure, you're right. But it poses a huge perception risk on the conflict of interest on our side, in the sense that even though this may not be a reality, that's the reality of independence, that is a perception issue. Imagine a situation where a firm audits us and also gets work from us. It's easy to formulate a perception that they may go easy on our books in the interest of maintaining that revenue base for themselves. And that's why we're sort of strict on that principle.
So that is where it is at. There are two bidders, and perhaps one is a small fry, perhaps I don't know whether they have the capacity and so forth. Mr. Mahlaba.
No, I think, Chairperson, the worrying factor is that both of them did not meet the requirements. Now, that is a question. So that means even if you do have those two, the worrying factor is to probably what is it that maybe is causing that even the one that is currently doing the work is now meeting the requirements. Maybe your stipulations have gone high, I'm not sure.
Unfortunately, the small one is very, very small. They don't even have the capacity. For instance, we had said that at least, you know, a candidate should at least be able to make minimum of 25 million upwards per annum in terms of their fees, which they generate from their own sources. But the one from Cape Town, you know, generates 1.8 per annum. And BDO, to our surprise, they say they make 21 million, you know, per annum. But unfortunately, we have not been able to ascertain whether this 21 million is for work, you know, within Pretoria only, because they've got a presence throughout the country. So we're not sure whether this 21 is for the whole country or is for Pretoria. But the recommendation which the chair of the committee would like to discuss with this committee is that we retain BDO, because they are close, you know, to the figure. They're 21 million. But we would like to discuss this, you know, it's called again, hear your views.
Yeah, I think perhaps let us agree that we shall have a meeting with the audit committee. But at the same time, I think the source of our concern, besides conflict of interest, was the length of association. And let us discuss those things at that meeting and see. But I think it is wiser to discuss it also with the audit committee, so that if a decision is taken, it is at the end of the day, it has the blessing of what can be perceived as an independent entity, with the support of an independent entity that can perhaps be in a position to protect the reputation of the office of the internal audit, because it is very important and it is in our interest to have a high reputation index of the institution of the Auditor General, because in turn it then becomes more effective in establishing or otherwise the integrity of government and the state, that is South Africa incorporated. So really we've got to balance and then discuss and then come towards a conclusion. But let us not further discuss this matter and wait for our discussion with the audit commission or audit committee. Temba.
Yes, Chairperson. I just wanted to check with the Office of the Auditor General. The initiatives to address vacancies. I don't know, but I've got the feel that whilst it might not be probably such close to us as part of our responsibility, but we do have interest in the success of this. On the budget and strategic plan on that page 10, where it talks about adoption of 15 high schools, the clerks, people who may not be interested in qualifying and so on. I think that's a very good initiative. But the one thing that I do have interest in as to how the whole process will unfold, so that we don't only get after a year that now it was not successful, or probably it could not yield the intended results. But the biggest one is the fact that we do have errors that have got challenges. Most of the time you'll find that these opportunities are only available in big cities and areas. You've got rural areas where you've got some of the children who are very good, but they end up just being wasted after their matric or after their high school because they don't have access into internet. They don't even know. They don't even see the newspapers. Now, some of these things need to target specific areas in a certain way. I'll make an example of currently in case that Zenex has been able to identify schools which have got maths and have been able to say that we are adopting these schools on a 5-year program because we've seen that you've got these subjects and so on, and they've looked at the poorer districts rather than going into Durban, and it part of those could be the former Model C which have transformed. There could be certain things that could be looked into. I'm not sure that we could be able to get some sort of assistance in that regard. Chairperson, I think it also includes that point of sponsor postgraduate bursaries and also the last bullet there. It's just that the second bullet, and then under corporate social investment, you've got your first, your second, your fourth, and the fifth.
So you are saying that even if it goes to your province, but it should be spread equally to all provinces, and then it should be also, it should also go to rural areas.
Now, Chairperson, I think if I can make an example with Eastern Cape, there's always been a problem of there are areas that where I may understand that they may have problems in getting staff. But on the other hand, we also need to look as to where is the greatest need in terms of improving the lives of the ordinary people.
Okay, I don't know who is responsible for the social this thing. That was who has got the detail. I think here we just want to get the feel, really.
In terms of, I think we have looked at the rural, the fact that it is difficult to attract skills to rural areas. We've experienced that. Provinces like your Northern Cape, your Eastern Cape, and what we have done from within the organization is to encourage those staff members that are willing to relocate to your rural provinces and even give them some form of incentive
to say if you are willing to move to the Northern Cape, we will sort of compensate you for that. So that's one intervention that we have come up with. In terms of, and I think the DAG will come in also and add on the social investment, what we have done in terms of identifying the schools in rural communities, especially in those areas where we are not able to identify or rather to attract skills that will go and work for us in our provinces, outlying provinces. Most of these 15 schools are actually based in those rural areas. And we're hoping that we will be able to identify your high flyers, your children that are very good in maths, and encourage them to follow the writing route, with the hope that finally they will go back to their provinces and pay back. That is our hope. We are also, it's just that the slide was very summarized. We are partnering with the Department of Finance in these interventions. We are also participating in the Tutuka School project. And basically we are saying we have identified the fact that it is difficult to attract people into rural areas, and all these interventions are to try and ensure that we attract people to those provinces. ADHD, I don't know what I want to add.
Yeah, just a quick question on the 15 high schools project. Just to build on the point, it certainly spread across the provinces as we have them in the country, but we felt that in each province let us at least have one school. And the way that we've done it in terms of starting to interact, whenever the AG has interacted in the provinces with either the MEC for Finance or MEC for Education, this matter would be brought up, because even the provinces themselves, in terms of their financial administration, they are struggling to attract their own people from their provinces, because they tend to be running away to urban centers. So once we picked this issue up, we actually have seen just how much appetite the MECs, particularly of education, of finance, in the provinces have for a project like this, to the extent that they've given us contact names within their provinces to say, so and so can assist you in identifying a school that has these qualities that we are mentioning. For example, a school that has got consistently good results in areas of math, that type of thing, or a combination of factors that we share with those MECs. So the first round of it, I mean, this is a program that is going to be run out of our transformation unit, and the idea around it is to prepare the ground for us when we want to recruit people after they finish off their matric. At least we know that we can get them to develop a sense of understanding of the AG, even at the early stages of their careers, so that when they come through the system, at least they can be able to relate to us when we go out to those universities to say, will you be prepared to sign up with us with a view to commencing your training contract, for example, in 3 years' time. So it's that type of approach which says that if we catch them early on in their careers before they've been given other ideas by the likes of Woolworths and so on, you know, that we are first in the queue kind of thing. And that's what we're trying to drive with this school's project, so that we don't think of recruitment. Currently the way it happens, and I think one of the things we've admitted when we did the risk assessment around our ability to fill vacancies, we've acknowledged the fact that we tried to approach people at the very end of their careers, when they've just completed their third year commerce and are about to decide whether they want to follow the accounting auditing route. That's when most of the time we have the very, very first contact with them. By that time they've already thought through their own career plans as to where they want to be in the future and so on. What this attempts to do for us is to say, let us grow with them. Because we know that when they finish their BCom and CTA, they still have to make decisions about where they want to go. So we think this is a shift significantly, which says that universities are the tail end of the process.
we want to catch them right at the beginning. And that's what we're trying to drive. And I guess the success for it will probably be seen in the impact that it makes, together with other initiatives on the area of vacancies in the medium to long term, I think.
Jim, may I make just a few points? I won't take long.
As long as your longest point is equal to mine.
Your strategic plan is a public document, so just if I can make a couple of observations, you might feel free to disagree. I prefer your new vision and mission statements. I think they definitely move in the right direction. But just on the mission statement, I think the literal or the grammatical way it's put, I thought, was not too elegant. So if you just look at the wording, especially of the first part of your mission, your strategic goals, the way you prioritize them, I think the way you put them up on the screen this morning was the correct order, where you said your focus areas, but improving your audit, improving your leadership, your governance, finally the issue of reputation. In your strategic plan document, you have it the other way around. So everything starts off with our reputation. I would say there's a logical order that your reputation basically flows from everything else, from having done a good job, from having led well. Just a thought. I don't feel very strongly, but I'm just mentioning those. Then on to the questions. And then we hadn't, if you don't mind, exhausted the capping thing. We can assume that, as in the past, once you've budgeted and you set your tariffs and your recovery rates, that's the way it stays for that financial year. Because, you know, once you lift the cap, I'd hate to know that we'd put your hand on an income cap, which if things start going wrong during the year, you can just open it. So just to know that there's a commitment that your tariffs remain for better or for worse during the year, whatever they might be. But the real issue is a yardstick to assess where we're going, because this constitutes quite a major shift in the office. With your tariffs that are now going to take you up to, say, 5-6% net surplus or 34% gross margin, those tariffs, how do they now compare to the private sector audit firms? And is the differential between those and the private sector audit firms, is it more than the profit margins of the private firms? Because that gives us a sense of whether you are accommodating excess overhead, so perhaps you can justify it or not. I hope you get that question now. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. The rates in terms of the comparison to private audit firms, I think we're still behind them. What percent? I'm going to ask Raj later on to add that detail, because he has done the exercise even in terms of comparing them to the SAICA rates. Maybe let me just pass it on to him, because he probably the right time for him to engage with this detail on the question. Raj?
Thank you, DAG. Chairperson, through you. Yes, in fact, the analysis we've done is that we use the SAICA tariffs as our baseline comparison, which is the kind of rate that we've agreed with SAICA firms for the services they provide to us. Acknowledging the fact that the commercial rate out there is generally higher than the SAICA tariff rates that we've agreed between the AG and SAICA members providing services to the AG, okay? So it's a negotiated rate. However, in comparing that to the revised AG rates, internal rates, to the SAICA rates, we are still below those rates, okay? Now, on average, we come out at 93%, okay, of the SAICA rates. But what it means is that the process we've used is that certain categories or bands of staff we've leveled. For example, a partner rate and a BE rate we've leveled. Okay, But when we look at the other categories, we are still below the SECA tariffs. Now, in context of extrapolating that, what we've done is that we've then taken an impact analysis of what those revised rates would mean on our auditees. And we took a sample of 9 auditees. Ideally, if you can put that one up. And we've then tested the impact of the proposed tariffs on those 9 auditees, and it averages about 34-35%. Now that's a once-off impact, okay, on the 9 auditees, and extrapolated, that's what we expect it to be on average. Now having said that, of course, going into the future, the principle that we've worked on is that if the other costs remains comparable in its ratio to the direct cost, then the impact going forward would be relative to your CPIX. Okay, so as long as your other costs within the office remains relative to the direct cost as we have it currently, then there's no reason why we would have a sort of rapid or a disruption in the rates going forward. So going on the screen there, if you can look at what we've done, we've broken it up between some municipalities, some nationals, and some specialized audits. And the impact, as you can see, the last column on the right-hand side demonstrates the impact of the increase percentage. And ideally, if you can just scroll down a little bit. Yeah, thanks. No, up. Oh, you can't get it. Okay. But it averages 34%. Okay.
Sorry, Chair. You're not quite answering my question, but thank you for that information. Yeah. Are you able to, in your new tariff regime, comparing that to the SECA rates as they apply to private sector audit firms, you don't know how much lower you are, because you should be lower because they built on profit. And their profit could be 10, 15, 20%. So are you 10, 15, 20% below them? If not, then it's just a little mental exercise I'd like to do to give me a reassurance of where you're at. Yeah.
Okay. thanks very much for that question. We did when initially last year, when the audit committee started looking at the financial statements themselves and said the margins that we are operating at, which were at that point sitting at around 28%, 29%, one of the issues, and some of those people that were in the room have been audit firm partners or are still linked to audit firms, but the kind of, we didn't do a specific analysis, but what the kind of percentage margin that private audit firms get overall for their entire business, including what work they do for us, is somewhere in the region of between 50 and 60%. They make a margin of between 50 and 60%, whereas ours is sitting in the 30s. Because in addition to their profit that they build into it, they also have additional other things that we don't have, things like professional indemnity insurance and various other types of things that they have, as well as a marketing cost as well that sits within there, whereas we don't have to market our stuff. The constitution is there to do the marketing for us. So I think the gap is somewhere in the region of about 20-odd%. They are 20-odd% higher than we are on the margin.
Chair, could I just also make further point? There's basically 3 tariffs involved in auditing as we experience it. First of all, our own tariffs, then the tariffs that the audit firms charge us for work that we allocate to them, and then there's the commercial rate, which we are way below the commercial rate out there. We don't know what their profit margins is because it's a top secret. As far, we tried to get close to it in terms of our research that we did, but we were not able to do that. But just having said that, we are under tremendous pressure to reconsider the tariffs that we allocate or that we allow for work that we contract out. We've more recently had a serious request from SECA to say that the firms are complaining and they're even reconsidering their option in terms of taking on work from the AG. So I just wanted to support what the DAG said. In terms of our own structure, we're way below the firms that are doing work for us.
I forgot.
Thank you, Chair. Just as a matter of interest on this, you know, we had in Scopa, we had the land bank, and we gave it quite a hard time. Why is the impact so great on the land bank? Because it's the only one that stands out at a 75.52% increase. And the land bank has not grown, as far as I know. Why is the impact on it so great, much greater than on the others?
If I can answer that, Chairperson, basically the mix of the specialist skills involved in handling the land bank audit, which is like a partner level kind of person, that's primarily used at the land bank because of the complexity of the audit. So it's a higher rate being applied. Okay. And what's happened, you may recall in my opening comments to Dr. Woods, I said that what we did is that we leveled the BE rate, which is our like a partner rate for the AG, to the SECA partner rate. So that's where we had the most significant movement. Thanks.
Not because you're going to do a better audit.
Sorry, Chair. Just to build up on that point, I think there were key things that were driving, among others, the growth in the fee for Land Bank. It was even discussed prior to the commencement of the audit by Ernst & Young, because this one is one of those audits that used to be done by Ernst & Young. When they did a risk assessment, they basically looked at quite a number of issues that they felt they needed to do at a minimum before they can sign off on the audit. And it was one of those audits that was given particular attention within Ernst & Young. So they said they will have additional people involved in it in order for them to mitigate the risk that they were assuming by continuing to audit the land bank. So that was the reason that from a fee point of view it went a lot higher than normal increases.
Thank you, Mr. Mugetu. In fact, I just want also to check whether we are making use of the National Skills Development Fund, the CETAS, in our training. And then if so, to what extent, and then if not, why not?
Chair, if that question relates to our own CETA, which is FACET, we are part of FACET and we are claiming for the training that we're doing as part of our training program. Yeah. And if you look at the budget numbers, there will be a line item for that. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I do accept that you are paying, but are you also training as well? Training people.
Just a most recent development which was brought to us through the development department of SAICA. SAICA came to us and said, you know, one of the things that you're struggling with, a lot of the people that you've employed are still starting towards qualifying. And they had entered into an arrangement with the University of Pretoria as well as the University of Johannesburg. But they were also in the process of drawing in other tertiary institutions who are going to be part of the program that they had come to share with us. And this program was about sourcing funds from FACET, who is the sector CETA, in order to have funds available to pay for lecturers who were going to provide additional academic support to our employed staff who are studying. So from that point of view, we were able to access through the SAICA initiative the funding from FACET in order to basically add to the initiatives we currently have so that we can facilitate people getting closer and quicker to qualify whilst they are starting. So it is those type of initiatives that we are part of. But certainly this one was spearheaded by the Institute of Chartered Accountants, but working with us, because they identified our people as potentially the ones who would benefit the most from it.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I think we have reached time to conclude this meeting, except if there is something very special.
Chair, yes, indeed. I think there is something that is special. Perhaps the legal team can just remind us on that, that as part of going through this document, there are specific decisions that SCOWEC needs to make. And I think one of them is around the tariffs. And to the extent that perhaps there may be additional information which may be required in addition to the ones that we've responded to, it would be good to know about that, so that as the new year kicks in, which is 1st April, at least to know that we've got tariffs that are approved. I think that's a requirement of the PAA to have the tariffs approved by SCOWEC. There is no specific mention of the date by when it should be approved, but I think on the balance of reasoning, it should be before they come into effect, which is the first of the new year, which is 1st of April next year. So any time between now and when you finalize the document, it would be useful to have that finalized, including the tariffs that will be published in the SAICA handbook as well. And I guess that's where we'll be able to pick up the differential between the AEG tariffs and the firm's tariffs for work done on behalf of the AEG.
Thank you very much, AEG. I think before you come in, Mr. Mahlama, I was of the impression that we were going to adopt everything at the next meeting. Including the tariffs. But in principle, really, I mean, we understand that the capping is gone. And the detail, I do not know whether we have in our documents, the bigger document. I was still reading it in the computer. And then if we do, I think let us, if it is in line with what you have proposed, let us finalize it at the next sitting, after meeting the auditors, the audit committee, and then finalize the issue of tariffs and other decision, and that is going to be before the end of November. Are you on that? Because I had Mr. Mahlama. Okay.
Just so that we can consider it when the chairperson, it's the same amount of detail here that used to be in the old way where you used to establish all your recovery rates, all that information here. Okay, then I would suggest here we have enough information to apply amounts and to come back with a decision next time.
Mr. Mahlama, thank you, Dr. Evans.
Now, chairperson, I hope I'll be the last one. Say forever will close. But mine was to assume that the acting chairperson is not only acting today, understanding that there would be preparations for the next meeting and so on. I'm not sure whether I am correct, or in the next meeting, if there is no finality on the matter, we'll come back and propose a new chairperson again. That's what I was trying to confirm with the members.
That's not on my terrain, unfortunately, Mr. Mahlama. And there is nothing we can confirm.
I'm not sure, acting chairperson. I know you're saying that you're not sure, but I was just checking with the members. I'm making an example that if there could be a need of an urgent meeting next week, so I'm not going to deal with anything after this meeting. That's it. It's finished. You're not going to coordinate nothing. That's why I was hoping that we understand that we've got an acting chairperson until otherwise we're told.
Okay, we are going to continue acting and coordinating and linking the committee with the auditor general until further advice otherwise. That is the position. But perhaps in conclusion, I think one has got to recognize the hard work that has gone into the presentation, and one has got to thank the Auditor General's office for maintaining the decorum that the nation is proud of, and perhaps on behalf of the committee, commit that ourselves that we shall continue to support your effort in the interest of the Constitution and eventually our nation. I therefore close this meeting. Thank you.